solution, but militarily it has completely failed.
Earlier, Yemen's armed forces carried out a retaliatory attack against the King Khalid Air Base in Azir using Qassam K2 drones. The Saudi war has brought about the world's worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen, according to the United Nations.
Observers say the ongoing operation by the Yemeni army has sent a clear message to Saudi Arabia, and that is, as long as the Saudi war and siege against Yemen is persist, Yemen's army will carry out more massive retaliatory attacks deep inside the kingdom. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A massive public outpouring in Peshawar, the regional capital of Pakistan's northwestern province of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa. Anger is boiling in Pakistan like elsewhere in the Muslim world over Israel's atrocities during the 11-day long conflict, which the United Nations said could amount to war crimes. Pakistanis are particularly furious over Israeli troops for desecrating Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem Al-Quds, Islam's third holiest site. Similar protests have also been held in major cities against Israel's plans to evict Palestinians from their homes in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Jerusalem Al-Quds.
We have a very deep-seated love for Palestine. It is a part of our belief system to live and die for Palestine. And that is why such a huge number of people have turned up in this protest.
The ongoing protests are mounting increasing pressure on Pakistani government to help Palestinian militarily to prevent another Israeli aggression. Pakistan has backed Turkey's demand to set up an international protection mechanism to prevent Israel's aggression in future, although the scope and reach of such a mechanism have yet to be established. Analysts believe that some non-Arab countries can form a joint military coalition in not-so-distant future.
We want the government to support us. We will go to Palestine to defend our brothers. But if Israel fights with us, then we will hit back.
More mass anti-Israel protests are expected in the coming weeks and months as different opposition parties are planning demonstrations across Pakistan. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
According to British daily The Sun, the US is going to follow a complex strategy regarding the withdrawal of its troops from Afghanistan. The Sun reported that Washington is going to keep hundreds of its forces in the country in order to avoid the collapse of Kabul by Taliban. According to the report, 600 US Marines could be deployed to protect the US embassy in Afghan capital. British and Turkish troops may reportedly assist the US forces. However, experts here believe such a move is part of Washington's psychological war against Afghans after spreading further fear among locals.
The US is after wickedness. It threatens us of the consequences of its withdrawal, such as the fate of women's rights. But we ask them to just leave our country. We know how to deal with the challenges.
In the meantime, many have named the US government as a symbol of imperialism that doesn't care about basic issues such as peace, human rights and liberties.
It's very naive to think that Americans came here to do anything with poverty, to do anything with peace building, to do anything with democracy or human rights. In fact, it's the other way around. The American presence, not in Afghanistan, but in the region and in the world, in the bigger picture, is to create more conflict, is to create more poverty, is to create more dependency to the United States.
As observers say, the U.S. and its allies want to draw a dark picture for the future of Afghanistan. Under such a scenario, the Afghan government will soon collapse by the Taliban and the country will go back to 1990s. In such circumstances, political elites in Afghanistan say, since Afghans have fully experienced the cost of foreign interference in their country over the past four decades, they need to firstly come together and make a united nation and then make a strong policy to deal with foreign players in line with their own national interests. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Hundreds of pro-Palestine protesters gathered outside the BAE Systems factory in Blackburn in the north of England to call upon the weapons manufacturer to stop supplying components for F-35 fighter jets that have been used in a recent bombardment of Gaza.
BAE, which is one of the largest companies in the UK supplying arms, parts of jets, fighter jets, to the Israeli terrorist state, which is bombing children, killing innocent people, and BAE is also funding other oppressive regimes like Saudi Arabia, and their arms are destroying the lives of innocent people.
The protest came on the back of one of the largest pro-Palestine demonstrations in British history on Saturday, and similar demonstrations throughout the week led by Palestine Action Group, who have been protesting outside the Israeli-owned Elbit Systems factory that provides drones, weapons and military hardware to the Israeli army.
We've seen protests in Leicester, Tamworth, Oldham and today in Blackburn as the anger amongst the British public begins to swell at the thought that British weapons are being used by the Israeli army to kill Palestinian children.
They're shooting kids, murdering little children. If that was their children, what would they say? So us lot standing here, we're going to stand out here and we're going to make noise for our people, our brothers and sisters are being oppressed. Free, free Palestine!
The name of the Jewish people is being misused. And the term anti-Semite, so-called anti-Semite, is being thrown around. Anyone who dare criticise strongly what the Zionists are doing is labelled as a Jew hater, and it's not true.
It's become increasingly clear that the British government's unwavering support for Israel is not representative of the feeling on the ground, with more than 383,000 Brits calling on their government to sanction the Israeli regime for their crimes against the Palestinian people. But while the UK remains complicit through the hundreds of millions of pounds worth of weapons sold to the Israeli army, some might wonder if the UK should also be held accountable. Ahmed Cabello, Blackburn.
To continue supporting the Palestinian cause, Yemen Zakat Authority has organized this event to distribute cash aid among the Palestinian community in Yemen and fundraise $1.5 million to the Palestinian resistance.
Today, we are honored to launch two projects. The first one is distributing cash aid among our families and brothers from the Palestinian community. We're also donating money to support the Palestinian resistance.
The head of the Zakat Authority said the Palestinian resistance proved it is capable of standing against Israel. Yemeni said what was presented in the ceremony is part of what is coming as Yemenis promise to support Palestinians until the liberation of their occupied lands.
There is no doubt that the amounts provided by the General Authority for Zakat are a simple contribution from the Yemeni people who are ready to even share their food with the Palestinian people. Yemenis hope that this money will help liberate Al-Aqsa Mosque from the Israeli occupation, and we believe that the Palestinian resistance is capable of doing this.
The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, called on Yemenis to stand by Palestinians, saying they will share a living if they have to. He urged Yemenis to carry on the fundraising campaign to help Palestine.
Despite being involved in a brutal war by the Saudi-led coalition, Yemenis say they will also stand by their Palestinian brothers with everything they have, even if they have to share a living. Abdul Latif Washali, Sana'a.
The seven candidates of Iran's 13th presidential election appear on TV and radio channels to convince voters by giving details of their programs. This time, due to the corona pandemic, campaigns mainly go on through TV channels and social media platforms.
My first priority is the production. I will boost the country's production and fight economic corruption.
The other one said it is time for a revolution in management methods and mechanisms of running the country.
It is time for deeper changes. A revolution is needed in management, which means an administration that fully merges with the people.
The next one was Mohsen Mehralizadeh, who said that production and creation of jobs will be among the top priority issues to be addressed.
I will take a serious step toward production and creation of jobs in the beginning of my administration, which is due to start in the second half of this year.
Abdel Nasser Hemmati, who is the current governor of Iran's central bank, emphasized that today nothing is more important than improving people's livelihood.
We must boost production through interaction in order to improve the livelihood of people.
Mohsen Rezaei, who has vied for the post several times, said he would appoint women in his administration.
Definitely, I'll use women in my cabinet, and at least two of my cabinet members will be women. The housewives would also get the necessary facilities to be able to earn money.
Earlier, Ebrahim Raisi also noted that the participation of youth in the electoral process will create a bright future for economic independence and prosperity. Campaigning for the seven candidates got underway on Thursday and will continue until the day before the election day. Human Abadi, Tehran.
According to Afghanistan's public health ministry, the third wave of COVID-19 is sharply spreading across the country and the government is bracing for the plight. As officials say, the government's decision to put a two-week ban on nearly half of the educational centers and universities is considered a precautionary measure to avoid further spread of the disease in the country. The public health ministry has also urged locals not to violate health protocols. However, locals here believe that attempts like this must be associated with other supportive measures by the government in order to convince ordinary people to stay at home.
Our people can't survive without government's financial support during lockdowns because poverty is widespread. Most families here can't survive if their breadwinners stay at home.
In the meantime, some others suggest that closure of educational centers and universities is not enough and that the government must put a ban on activities of all public sites such as swimming pools, wedding halls, sports clubs and even religious sites.
Confronting the third wave of COVID-19 can be fruitful only if the public and private sectors take it seriously. So all public sites, including swimming pools and wedding halls, should also be put on lockdown.
As observers say, the Afghan government will have a tough task to confront the spread of the third wave of COVID-19 pandemic due to shortage of medical equipment. This comes despite receiving millions of dollars in aid by regional and international states and bodies. Based on official figures, over 70,000 Afghan individuals have been affected by the disease so far, and some 3,000 others have also lost their lives over the past year. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Activists are galvanizing opposition to the government's planned controversial policing bill, which is now close to becoming law, highlighting a number of issues as more Kill the Bill protests are planned.
It's a massive assault on our democratic right to protest in this country. Let's be clear here. This is specifically aimed at the environmental movement, thousands of young people on the streets demanding that we tackle the climate emergency, and the Black Lives Matter movement, thousands of young people on the streets demanding justice for black people. And when the government saw these two movements in the summer of last year taking to the streets as they did, they decided that they needed to put in place the most draconian legislation.
Many anticipate a new wave of protest as concerns over the right of assembly grow.
I think this will be the government's poll tax movement moment, and we'll see thousands and thousands and thousands of people in cities right across the country, as we have over the last 3 months, stepping up the campaign against this bill. But it's an absolute disaster for democracy in Britain.
The bill could also have a devastating impact on other marginalised communities in Britain.
This government is conducting a culture war. That's what it's doing. It's trying to undermine and eliminate aspects of black culture, Muslim culture, traveller culture. And when you think that people have had a way of life for thousands of years, and now you're going to introduce legislation, rather than facilitating their way of life as British people within a multicultural democracy, you're actually going to introduce a law that denies them their very way of life.
Criticism of government plans will continue amid fears that the potential damage might be irreversible.
The Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill continues to see mass opposition up and down the country, with experts deeply concerned about the potential long-term impact on civil liberties. Richard Sudam, London.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
An extensive network of U.S.-based pro-Israel lobbying groups working hand-in-hand with Israeli regime spy agencies continue to fund multi-million dollar campaigns to destroy Palestinian liberation struggles and ensure professional legal and financial consequences for Americans who dare to speak out against Zionist regime apartheid. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Karen Holmes, reporter. This article is published under the heading, Zionist Groups in U.S. Operate Campaigns to Quash Palestine Solidarity on Campus. Stay tuned for more. As the world bears witness to the violent disposition of Palestinians at the hands of the Israeli regime's apartheid regime, this very same regime is conducting a parallel project of suppression, censorship, and surveillance in the United States of America. An extensive network of U.S.-based pro-Israel lobbying groups working hand-in-hand with Israeli regime spy agencies continue to fund multi-million dollar campaigns to destroy Palestinian liberation struggles and ensure professional legal and financial consequences for Americans who dare to speak out against Israeli regime apartheid. College campuses have become a central battleground of the lobby suppression efforts. Groups like Students for Justice in Palestine, SJP, pose a major threat to long-term bipartisan support for the Zionist regime as their campaigns unsettle pro-Israel political narratives and introduce young people to the violent realities of the occupation. While pro-Israel organizations that intervene in campus activism often try to do so under the radar, their counterinsurgency strategies and patterns are being exposed. In 2016, Al Jazeera sent an undercover journalist to intern and network within the Washington, D.C.-based Israel lobby. His reporting confirmed what many advocates for Palestine already suspected. The lobby is funding complex surveillance operations to undermine Palestine activists, particularly those on college campuses. Jacob Baim, the executive director of the Israel on Campus Coalition, ICC, was caught on undercover footage boasting about the organization's multi-million dollar surveillance technologies and smear campaign tactics. The group's strategy, he revealed, is fabricating allegations of anti-Semitism against activists in order to create a sense of crisis. The ICC conducts oppositional research, defames activists using anonymous websites, and promotes these defamations using targeted Facebook promotions. BAME's associate, Noah Polak, admits that defamation is a major feature of the lobby's strategy to suppress criticism of Israel, noting, "You discredit the messenger as a way of discrediting the message." filing complaints with the Department of Education became a highly effective tool for Israel lobbying organizations under the Trump administration. For the fake regime of Israel, the war of public opinion, particularly in the West, remains an essential feature of its national security strategy. The Israeli regime enjoys unconditional and bipartisan political support within the United States Congress, an asset leveraged to the tune of $10 million each day in military aid. It's no surprise that the Israeli regime invests enormously in preserving public support for Israel and subsequently working to neutralize organizations, groups, and individuals engaged in critique of Israel's illegal occupation and institutionalized apartheid. Both the Trump and Biden administrations have acted in lockstep with this systematic repression campaign. In September 2020, the U.S. State Department under Trump committed to target, fight, and kill the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, BDS, a nonviolent economic boycott campaign. The Biden administration also signaled its commitment to disenfranchising Palestine advocates when his Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, affirmed that the administration enthusiastically embraces the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism. The consequences of these coordinated suppression efforts are not hypothetical. They consume the political and professional careers of many Palestine solidarity activists. Recently, amid the bombing of Gaza, Emily Wilder, a Jewish journalist with the Associated Press, was fired following a campaign from right-wing groups who condemned her years of advocacy with the Students for Justice in Palestine. It's evident that the Israeli regime's continued investment in surveillance and defamation campaigns is likely to continue to have a chilling effect, not only on the movement for Palestinian liberation, but more widely on free speech. But the enormous demonstrations, like taking place around the world in solidarity with Palestinian resistance to evictions in Al-Quds, suggest the Zionist regime has lost the moral argument. While its lobbying power holds, many people are no longer finding Israeli regime's propaganda campaigns convincing. The regime's lobbying arms can no longer discredit the message that Israel is a settler colonial apartheid regime and instead invest in discrediting the messenger. A member of TUFT, SJP, says that while they are heavily out-resourced by pro-Israel lobby organizations, SJP campaigns are still finding success. Young people are increasingly rejecting the occupation and standing in solidarity with Palestinian freedom fighters. Activists can perhaps take solace in knowing that Israeli regime's expansion of coordinated repression is evidence of the movement's ability to threaten the material support for colonialism, apartheid, and violence that is at the heart of the Israeli regime occupation of Palestine.
The debate.
The News has emerged that the U.S. used Denmark's Secret Service to spy on top European officials, including the German Chancellor Angela Merkel and her then-foreign minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier. Even though the U.S. would not admit to this, didn't the former intel contractor Edward Snowden reveal that the U.S. government was spying on its allies? Well, in this edition of the debate, we will look at the depth of the U.S. spying and whether the U.S. was the only one that was spying on its allies and the reasons behind wanting to spy on its allies. First, let's cross on over to Paris. Chris Dunhand joins us. Well, Chris, tell us about this, the spying allegations, how true it is, and the countries that are involved in this.
Well, the French Europe Minister Clément Beaune reacted immediately by saying that if these allegations are proven to be true, it's a very serious matter and it must be investigated very seriously. Also, Germany reacted immediately by saying, by asking clarification, because there is alleged spying on German Chancellor Angela Merkel and former Foreign Minister Steinmeier. These are really top European politicians. The Denmark defense minister declined comments on these allegations, but he admitted that spying of allies is unacceptable. Now, the strange thing is that since the Edward Snowden affair in 2013, who revealed that the CIA and the National Security Agency, NSA, spied on its own citizens and also on its allies, apparently since 2013, nothing has changed. That's maybe one of the questions for the debate, because Snowden, as a famous whistleblower, he has been sanctioned himself because he has been threatened as a spy himself. He had to leave the country and to find shelter in Russia. So the Danish media revealed that the United States continued spying on its allies even after the revelations of Snowden. So this is a very serious matter. It's not proven yet. So the first reactions of top European ministers like Clément Beaune are rather strong, but it has to be seen how far they will go and how far they can go in finding proof for these very serious allegations.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Chris Dunhand there from Paris. Let me bring in journalist and independent political analyst Geroy Coleman, who joins us also from Paris. Geroy Coleman, welcome. So what are we looking at over here, and what is your reaction? I mean, if we want to break it down, which we're going to get into, but the news initially reads Denmark's Secret Service helping the U.S. National Security Agency, NSA, to spy on European leaders, and included the German Chancellor Angela Merkel and now President Frank-Walter Steinmeier. What's your reaction to that?
I think this needs to be understood in the Russian-German geopolitics and the U.S. role in that. We must understand that Denmark is a key player in the Nord Stream 2 pipeline project between Germany and Russia. And this is something that the United States have been trying to sabotage for a very long time. And they've been putting pressure on various European countries to do that. In particular, France has been exerting a lot of pressure on the Germans to pull back. Germany is very much involved. They're very much in favor of going ahead with this project. And Denmark is a key player because in October of last year, the Danish Maritime Authority gave the go-ahead for the construction of Nord Stream 2. And again, in January of this year, construction started. So I think we need to sort of understand that that's the geopolitical context in which this revelation has been made. The revelation itself is not major. It has been known for a very long time that the U.S. spies on Europe. I mean, they spy on everyone, and they spy on their own politicians, they spy on their allies. In this, in the game of geopolitics, there are no friends, there are just interests. And major interests here, of course, are billions of dollars in energy contracts. And that is really, I think, the context in which this, in my opinion, in which this story is sort of breaking right now. Denmark has been force of quite a lot of controversy recently also with migration crisis, where they stopped migration flowing to Denmark, and that created a lot of controversy as well. So that could also be linked, of course, because there's a lot of politics around the management of this, of the migration crisis. But to come back to the oil pipeline crisis, I do think that is the center, the key issue here behind this espionage revelation.
Okay. Let's bring in Mike Harris. He's an editor at Veterans Today who joins us. Mike Harris, welcome. So I don't know if you heard what our guests there said. I'd like to find out from you, first of all, the general conception or the general understanding of spying is that everyone spies on each other. I don't think I should say the U.S. takes the lead on that, but does it? And is it also true that they all spy on each other? And of course, the immediate question is, why would allies want to spy, in this case, the U.S. on Germany, let's say?
Well, let's answer your question in three parts here. One is, that's what intelligence agencies do, is they spy. And they do this through bribery, human compromise, blackmail, in order to bend people to their will, in order to get them to do things that they normally would not do. They do this in an effort to direct policies that would be beneficial to the people of their own country, to change those policies so that they're beneficial to the U.S. or whoever the spying agency is. So that's the first question. And I'll quote, everybody familiar with the phrase from The Godfather, Don Corleone, keep your friends close and your enemies closer, which really was he quoted that from Sun Tzu. But the issue is that that is the nature of intelligence agencies. That is what they do. They spy on friends, allies, enemies, everyone is what they do. And domestically here, the U.S. intelligence agencies are spying on our own citizens, which is really quite unconstitutional and unfortunate for those of us who live under what is becoming a very authoritarian regime.
Okay.
Number two is no, the U.S. is not the most prolific spying country in the world. We're rivaled very closely by both Israel and China at this point in time. They're both been very, very active, internationally and domestically here in the U.S. So those are two of your questions there. So it's an unfortunate thing when they get caught at it. But as the previous guest had stated, there's a lot of money at stake. There's money on the table here, and it's pretty obvious to the entire world that the Biden administration is for sale.
Okay,
they're here to.
Mike Harris, I want to make sure that I understood the first part of what you said correctly, because I'm going to throw that onto our guest, Gerard Coleman. And you said that spying is done in order to have countries do what, let's say, the U.S. wants and to guide towards the U.S. goal in a particular, in a particular environment conducive to what the U.S. wants. Is that what you... am I correct to understand you that way, that the countries spy on each other to get information to guide and push that particular country towards, let's say, a policy that the U.S. wants to enact, for example?
Yes, exactly. And we see the same thing in our country, that Israel does the same thing to us and our politicians. They're constantly spying and constantly blackmailing our politicians to bend us to their will.
Okay.
So this is pretty much a universally accepted way of doing business in the intelligence community.
Okay, Gerard Coleman, so do you agree with that? And can you give us examples, if you can, in the case of Nord Stream 2, if that applies, how it is that this is coming in that context, and whether the U.S. is going to be able to get Germany to follow what it wants, which is not to go with Russia on this?
Well, yes, I would agree with the fact that Israel is the key security threat to the United States because of the overwhelming control they have over the telecommunications industry and increasingly the internet. Just recently, there was a meeting between Benjamin Netanyahu and Lindsey Graham. And Lindsey Graham said, Senator Lindsey Graham said that more than Five Eyes, the Five Eyes, Britain, Australia, New Zealand, and so on, the official kind of spy alliance of the United States, Britain, and Australia and New Zealand. He said more than the Five Eyes, Israel was the eyes of America, essentially. So they have and they, of course, they said they do sell that information to the Chinese, which is to think of what your other guest said there. China's power very much depends on its ability to get information from Israel, and Israel has easy access. So, there are no allies in this game, as far as I can see. There's just, you know, interests, and because of the, I think because of the interconnectivity between the corporate sector, big business, and intelligence, the military-industrial complex is so complex that it's very difficult to tell and to control information. One of the things that sort of comes out from this crisis again, and when it emerges, becomes very clear, is that Europe has no sovereignty whatsoever, and any pretensions it has of defense, of mounting a defense policy, is ridiculous. It has been a project of the United States since the Second World War, and it continues to be, play second fiddle to the United States. So, the idea that, politicians are shocked by this, I just don't buy that. I think they've known this for a very long time, that, U.S. spies on them. Of course, as your guest said, French have spied on the Americans too. It's not anything new. The big question here is, why is Denmark in the middle of this?
Right.
No proof that Danish intelligence services have done anything untoward or have done anything that any other state has not done. I think the geopolitical issue I discussed there is probably the reason why there's a focus on blaming Denmark right now, because the Danes have given authority to Nord Stream. The European Union is against it, and I think now they're sort of ganging up on Denmark.
So, Mike Harris, why was the Danish government involved? Why did it decide to actually work with the NSA and proceed in what, like our guests there said, and what has been revealed, that it actually spied on many countries in Europe? So the question, in cooperation with the NSA, but why Denmark in this case?
Well, if you look at Denmark's strategic position here with the global fiber optic network, that puts them at a very easy access nexus there, where they can filter and take in information from both east and west, all of Europe, all of Russia, all of North and South America. Everything goes through a hub in Denmark. And that is why Denmark was a very, very logical insertion point for the spying to take place. That's really what the rub is there, is where can you get access to what's going on over the fiber? And Denmark was one of the places.
Okay, Jacques Wallman, let's take this a step further, the whole spying thing. It is reported that when there are, for example, UN meetings that take place, whether it's in New York or whether it's in Europe, that anywhere these countries and the representatives are, in terms of, let's say, the foreign ministers or the diplomats, they're being spied on, and they're being tapped, and they're being watched. And whatever intricacies are involved in their thoughts and in their policies, it's being listened to, extracted, and then there's a reaction. Are we looking at policies being changed, altered, and then presented based on the spying that takes place? Because if that's the case, then I don't know if you see where I'm going with this. There's going to be a whole series of events that could happen that would not be to the betterment of whatever cases may be presented. In this case, I use the example of the UN.
Well, I think that we're in a situation where we're essentially living in a matrix, in an information matrix, where everything is being spied on. Every citizen is under surveillance, and that is increasing. I mean, as the this scandal broke today in France, as they were discussing it, they're passing laws to put biometric identity cameras all over the place to make sure everybody's wearing a mask and to make sure everybody's doing what they're told, and further laws which enable them to track people on the internet to see what you're looking at, to see what and to listen in. This is happening almost by the week, that we have more and more violation of privacy. And so we are moving towards a world where essentially everyone, every citizen, is under total surveillance. And of course, that is going to affect our behavior, because we have to be careful about what we say, and you have to. So, if you're in a, when it comes to state level, obviously, it poses a major problem, because again, there's a question of who has this access to this information, and how can a state have any sovereignty? But of course, the question of sovereignty presupposes that there is such a thing as a nation. And we've seen the last 20, 30, last half century, that the nation has been one of the things that the oligarchs wanted to destroy. And so there really isn't any sovereignty left in these countries anyway. It's really just corporate interests and the interface of corporate and media and industrial interests. There really isn't any national interest left, in my view.
Well, the thing that's very perplexing here, Mike Harris, is the fact that when we take a look at Denmark, what has been reported is that the Danish foreign and finance ministries, for example, the Danish intelligence helped the U.S. spy agency NSA to spy on them. So basically, you're having the Danish spy on their own ministries. And then you also have a Danish intel ministry to help the U.S. spy on its different ministries, which then means that the U.S. is spying on itself. Doesn't quite make sense that you're having this Danish ministry spy not only on its own country, but then having the U.S. spy on entities within the U.S.
Or any other government that there is. You have to look at it that there's a they're not a monolith. They don't all think in the same manner. You have different factions. You have different elements in there which have different goals. Now, in the question of Denmark as to why their own intelligence agencies would be spying on other ministries, you have to ask why. You know, are they being leveraged? How are they being leveraged? And by whom and to what ends? Or are they in agreement with goals that the U.S. has that those ministries needed to be checked somehow? Maybe the intelligence of folks didn't feel that the finance ministry was acting in the best interest of the Danish people. This is a complex issue that I have not had the time to do the analysis on, but there's always competing interests within any government, whether it's the U.S. government, whether it's the Danish government, whether it's the British, French, German, whatever, and they have different goals, and how they achieve those goals is really kind of up in the air. And then this is a game of constant leverage, constant pressure as to how you can get other people to do your will. And that's really what the whole spying issue is about, is to getting people to do things they wouldn't normally want to do, but you leverage them by bribery, blackmail, human compromise, whatever, to make them do what it is you want for fear of being exposed for some other nefarious reason. But that is the business of what the intelligence agencies do. That's how they gain their power. That's how they exert their power, is through those vehicles of bribery, human compromise, and blackmail. That's what they do.
Okay, taking all those acts that our guest there, Mike Harris, said, Gerard Coleman, can you give us another example that, in essence, there's manipulation that happens based on the different acts that our guests there said? If you can give us an example, you talk about the Nord Stream. If there are any other ones of significance.
I didn't get the last big segment there, unfortunately.
Mike Harris talked about how it's being used as leverage, the information that's extracted through the spying. I'm asking whether you can give us another example, aside from what has happened with Nord Stream, of this being used as leverage or manipulated to obtain the goals of the certain countries who are doing this. Let's, for example, the U.S. or any other country you can give us an example of.
Well, there, I mean, threats, I presume your guest mentioned threats. You can threaten people with death, for example, accidents can happen. I remember a few years ago, there was a helicopter accident Angela Merkel had. There was no official mention of a conspiracy to kill her, but it was a rather unusual helicopter accident, and they had to land and make an emergency landing. These are the kinds of things that can happen when a leader is not playing ball. Plane crashes have been known to happen. The French, for example, during the Cold War, got rid of many African leaders that way by organized plane crashes. So these are classic, I guess, these are classic assassination techniques. So, that can happen. And of course, you can have coups, color revolutions. Obviously, that's not going to happen in Germany because it's already playing ball on most social issues. So this is a much trickier dossier, I think, for the U.S., how to stop the pipeline project. I mentioned the role of coercive engineered migration, which is where you escalate a migration crisis to put pressure on the state. And we saw examples of that 2016 crisis where the Turkish leader Erdogan was leveraging the refugees and the migrants and threatening the EU in order to get to gain, you know, bargaining power. So these are things, for example, I mentioned earlier that the Danes had already created controversy because they had closed borders to foreign migrants. I mean, that's something, you know, we could see that escalating perhaps in the next few months, where the Danes are under more pressure with far more migrants coming than they previously would have thought. So there are many examples of that, and there are, you know, these are the kind of tricks that intelligence agencies play all the time.
Thank you very much for that. We're going to unfortunately end the debate. We're fresh out of time. Krista Hahn, of course, wanted to spoke at the top of the debate. Editor at Veterans Today, Mike Harris, thank you for your thoughts. And journalist and independent political analyst, Geoffroy Coleman, there from Paris. But that does it for this edition. Do join us for the next one. From Mikhail Tatlay, the entire team is goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, self-conceit. Self-love and self-concern in proper measure is necessary for survival. But if it exceeds the bounds, it becomes selfishness and self-conceit. The self-conceited people never look at their own faults and consider themselves responsible, pure, faultless, and important in the society. For this reason, they have a lot of unreasonable expectations from people, and this causes widespread anger against them. Imam Ali alayhi salam has said, "He who is self-conceited will find a lot of people dissatisfied with him." One of the factors which must be avoided is self-conceit. It dismembers the society and leads to the effacement of religious acts. Self-conceit means that one is pleased with himself and considers himself superior to others, whether he has an accomplishment or not. In other words, he is proud of himself. Brothers and sisters, unfortunately, in today's world, in today's time, in today's society, in this postmodernism, we are a victim of self-conceit. Unfortunately, people feel happy when they follow this attitude. And this is very sad. Islam teaches us humility, humbleness. Even if we have acquired and achieved something, Islam teaches us to be humble, to thank Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and to treat others with the respect they deserve. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the topic of self-conceit. And we said, unfortunately, it is prevalent today. And in some cases, our youth are a very strong victim of this spiritual disease. Some people have said that self-conceit means to magnify a feature while forgetting its source. Beyond doubt, when someone does a praiseworthy act, like keeping vigil, it is a source of delight to him. If he considers it as a blessing from Allah and he fears Allah at the same time, such a condition is not self-conceit. But if he considers it as from himself and from God and sees it as something great, it is as if he lays God under an obligation for having performed prayer or having fasted. And in this case, it is considered as self-conceit. Well, let's take it. We all feel good when we do good, right? We all feel good when we help a poor person, let's say, or a needy person, or someone sick, right? We feel good. Now, the question is this feeling in my heart that I did something good, so I'm happy with myself, is it something that is self-conceit? Well, the answer is no. No, when you know that this ability to help this poor person or to take care of an orphan or to help someone who is sick, it is an ability given to you by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He is the one who is in control. It's His mercy that He chose you to do this job. Then it's not self-conceit. But if you're feeling good about yourself without taking into consideration that Allah is the one who made it happen for you, then you are a victim, or you may be a victim of self-conceit. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.